לפני שמתחילים, הודעה קצרה. אם אתם אוהבים את הפודקאסט הזה, אתם כנראה אנשים ממש מיוחדים ומרתקים. אז אם בא לכם לפגוש עוד אנשים כמותכם, וגם אותי, וגם את רלי, אנחנו עושים מפגש עוקבים שלישי. ביום חמישי, בתאריך 9 למאי 2024, בין השעות 7:30 ל-11:30, אנחנו הולכים לקיים מפגש עוקבים שלישי בבית שלי בנופים בשומרון. מה בתוכנית? מינגלין וכיבוד עם עוד עוקבים מרתקים כמוכם, הרצאה שלי, דיון לגבי הערוץ, ציור בסטודיו ובסוף קומזיץ ופיתות על הסאג'. הרשמה מראש היא חובה וניתן לעשות את זה בקישור שבתיאור הערוץ או לחפש את הלינק ביוטיוב. נשמח מאוד מאוד לראות אתכם. ועכשיו לשיחה. This is a short Hebrew introduction to my conversation with Dr. Jonathan Reisman, the author of The Unseen Body. If you want, you can jump right into the conversation on the timestamp below. שלום לכולם, לי קוראים רועי יוזביץ'. בשיחה שאתם הולכים לשמוע, דיברתי עם דוקטור ג'ונתן רייזמן. הוא רופא שהיה בכל כך הרבה מקומות ברחבי העולם ומבין את הקשר שבין רפואה ובין תרבות. לאחרונה הוא כתב ספר שנקרא The Unseen Body, ובעצם הספר הזה מדבר על נפלאות הגוף האנושי. הפרקים בספר מחולקים לאיברים, כן? הידיים, הלב, הגרון, ויש גם פרקים שקשורים לצרכים, לנזלת, לשתן ולעוד כל מיני דברים אחרים. זאת הייתה שיחה מרתקת על גבולות האבולוציה, כן? במשך הרבה מאוד זמן, ג'ונתן רייזמן חשב שיש בעיה אבולוציונית עם הרעיון של הגרון, שאם היינו מתכנתים את זה, היינו מתכנתים את זה טוב יותר, כן? הקנה והוושת שטעות אחת, שיכולה לקרות כמה פעמים ביום, היא פטלית. אבל ככל שהזמן עבר, הוא ראה שדווקא המנגנון הזה, שעל פניו הוא מאוד מאוד מוזר, יש בו צדדים מאוד מאוד חשובים, גם לשרידות של המין האנושי, וגם כמו כפתור שאט-דאון של המערכת. אז אם מעניין אתכם שיחה על גוף האדם, על גבולות של אבולוציה מצד אחד, והתרבות מהצד השני, השיחה הזאת היא מרתקת. ועכשיו, דוקטור ג'ונתן רייזמן. דוקטור ג'ונתן רייזמן, thank you so much for coming today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so with your permission, let's start. Your book, or your wonderful book, is called The Unseen Body, and the subtitle is A Dr. Journey Through the Hidden Wonders of Human Anatomy. Okay? And I would like to start with a very simple question. You say unseen because we can't see the body. Everything that is so interesting is inside our skin.
Well, the outside is interesting too, for sure, in a different way. I think I try to draw a distinction there between the way we live our normal daily life, mostly on the surface of the body, you know, seeing the surface of other people's bodies, touching other bodies with the surface of ours, surface of theirs. But like most people, before I went to medical school, I did not know much about what goes on beyond that, what's going on deeper in the body with the internal organs, but also deeper in the sense of the microscopic level, the molecular level, which the cellular level, all of those are also, of course, a deeper way of seeing the body than we do on the level of daily life. So with my book, I was trying to, in a way, pull back the curtain on what goes on in our bodies, sort of the unseen aspects of the body that we don't think about or know about or deal with on a daily basis, but also kind of other unseen aspects of life, such as how medical education, medical training are, you know, behind the scenes of the healthcare system, behind the scenes of my daily job working in an emergency room. So it's sort of various unseen aspects of the body. And I was hoping to, with this book, pull back the curtain on all of them to show people something perhaps they had not seen or understood before.
I think it's so the idea of usually the best analogy for the human body is the incredible machine, the most incredible machine in the world. And as a doctor, as an MD, like a I don't know, medical deity used to say, I don't know who said it, just a second, Barney Siegel used to say that the acronym for MD is medical deity. So the idea is, do you consider the analogy of the incredible machine sufficient to explain the wonders of the body, or we can, if we go with that analogy up until the end, machine cannot fully explain the complexity and the intersection of so many subsystems within this body?
Right. I think there's different ways to look at the body. And one is as a machine or as a mechanism or as a almost sort of like a mechanical robot. That does, I think that explains a lot of it, not all of it for sure. The human body does have so many different mechanisms that all sort of are balanced and interact appropriately and sort of regulate each other. You know, the body has regulation on top of regulation on top of regulation, even when it comes to something like the blood clotting. We have factors that push the blood towards clotting. We have factors that push the blood away from clotting. We have factors that affect the factors that push it towards clotting and factors that affect those factors. So it's all this sort of swirling factors and enzymes and proteins and things that are sort of all regulating each other, managing each other, raising levels, lowering levels of each other. So I do think there's sort of a brilliant mechanism to the body, and one of the wonderful aspects of becoming a doctor and going to med school was learning about how incredible that mechanism is and how well balanced and how well regulated and how we, you know, our body continues to function normally, hopefully, when we're healthy without us really having to think about it at all. Things just happen. And we don't need to, you know, we don't need to think about keeping, let's say, the bacteria on our skin out of our bloodstream. Our body just does that. So we don't die of sepsis every day, which is pretty convenient. Or that our blood does clot with all those factors so that when you get a nosebleed, you know, or a paper cut, you're not just bleeding to death. So those are important mechanisms, of course. I think you can also, as a doctor, another aspect though was sort of also the social aspect. So not only do you have to understand the many interacting and interlacing mechanisms of the body, but you have to be able to interact with patients, talk to them, you know, like a human, not like they're just a mechanism presenting with some faulty aspect of the body that you need to fix, but you have to deal with people, their emotions, their fears, their worries, their psychology. You know, I often say that when you work with, like, let's say in a newborn nursery or a neonatal ICU, I often say that's the only medicine that involves no psychology of the patient. There's basically zero psychology. There's a ton of psychology of the parents, of course, who are going through probably the scariest time of their life. But the baby itself is almost this pure mechanism with no psychology attached, which I find very interesting and beautiful. But in every other aspect, psychology and other factors do play a huge role.
This is great. You know, one of Israel's leading philosophers in the last 30 years was Professor Yeshayahu Leibovich. I don't know if you're familiar with the name. And he was a medical doctor by training. And he used to say that his teacher at Berlin University used to say, "Gentlemen, there are no diseases in the world, only sick people." So the idea of disease is something that you can learn in a Harrison internal medicine, like in a book. But in real life, you will always see the combination of the disease with the person, with the personality, with the willpower, with the belief, with the faith, with everything. So what you just said about, you know, babies are the only part of the hospital where no psychology plays part, I think it's a very profound idea.
Yes, I agree. And I think that it's also important to note, you know, let's say the disease of pneumonia. Obviously, pneumonia does not exist outside of the lungs of any individual person. There's no platonic ideal of pneumonia floating out there somewhere. But that's part of the trick of medicine is you have to know the sort of platonic ideal of the disease and all the potential signs and symptoms that it could present with. But then every individual case of pneumonia, every set of human lungs that comes to you coughing with fever or whatever signs and symptoms, no two are ever the same, of course. No two bodies are ever the same, and no two cases of pneumonia are ever the same. So you're sort of applying this abstract ideal to the individual case. And that is sort of a less mechanistic thing that we also have to do when we're evaluating patients.
Yes. Now, your book is the chapters of your book are dealing with specific body parts: throat, heart, thyroid, genitals, liver, pineal gland, brain, skin, etc. And beside brain, we are always told that we are 99% similar with our DNA with apes. Besides the brain, which I think is the most significant organ that is different, how your book apply to, let's say, apes? I can take what you said about hands and feces and everything and say, okay, this basically apply to apes.
I think the mechanistic side of the body certainly does apply to animals. You know, if you look at a human heart versus a gorilla's heart, they might look different on the surface. Of course, as you the further you zoom in to the cellular level, the molecular level, you probably gets harder and harder to differentiate them. But I certainly think, obviously, the human brain, which created modern medicine and all the medicines and procedures and capabilities we have to intervene when the body's mechanism is failing. And not to mention the social aspects of medicine I mentioned and the human interaction side of it. You know, I guess clearly some apes are more social than others, but I think, you know, that's certainly a very big part of it is how social humans are, but obviously also our ability to use tools, create new tools, and sort of understand things that we can't see on the macroscopic level. I don't know. It would be interesting to know how much can a smart ape know about the inside of their own bodies. You know, I often think that animals that hunt might get a little bit of an understanding since sometimes they're opening up their prey, seeing what's inside. I don't know how much the average ape is thinking about what those shapes are in there and what they do, or if they perhaps understand that, oh, inside me is the same things. You know, when I dissected my cadaver starting on the first day of medical school, I thought it was so fascinating because not I was looking inside this old man who I didn't know, learning about his body, but of course I was also at the same time learning about what's inside my own body and what's inside the body of everybody else I would ever meet or know or evaluate as a doctor. So I do wonder how much people can understand. And I also think about prehistoric people, how much I think that they probably knew a lot more than we give them credit for about what's going on inside the body.
Yeah, definitely. We had the we had Galanos, and we have like the ancient doctors of the of ancient times. We have Maimonides, and I think that what they knew was, again, I think that you just nailed it. They knew much more than what we assume or presume that they knew. I once read that the pig heart is the most similar to the human heart.
Yeah, in size in particular, actually, pig organs are very similar to human organs in size, which is why they can. There's some experiments now with sort of, you know, gene editing these pig organs and then implanting them into people. But size is important. You know, if a baby needs a new liver, you can't just take an adult liver and put it in their abdomen. There's simply no room to fit it in there. So pig organs do come in handy, and we do use, for instance, pig heart valves, and we even use cow heart valves too, currently to implant into people's hearts when the valves of their heart fail. And it depending on which valve you take from which part of the heart, it can fit in different parts of the human heart because of the size. So, but yes, size-wise, we are very similar to pigs. It's true.
I always considered it one of God's greatest jokes or greatest lessons because, you know, in Judaism, pig is the most unkosher animal there is. You know, dog is just like unkosher like pig, but pig became a symbol. I think it's like if you can say it from as a lesson from God, say the most unkosher, the most unclean animal is very similar to you. And you need to observe this. I think it's a great lesson. Now,
That is interesting.
in the introduction of your book, you practice medicine in many different parts of the world. And my from your travels and medical experience, what has been the most astonishing example of the human body adaptability, the ability to adapt to extreme environments or situations?
Well, I think. Yes, yeah, so I've been lucky enough to practice medicine around the world, and that was kind of one of my driving forces to make me interested in going to medical school was the thought of sort of traveling as a doctor, providing medical care and out of the way in remote and rural places, which I do now, and it's quite rewarding and enjoyable and interesting. I think, you know, I guess there's different kinds of adaptation, right? There is physiologic adaptation to extremes. For instance, I worked at high altitude in Nepal. I was stationed at around 11,500 feet above sea level for a few months, and treating people with altitude sickness. And certainly, the ability to adapt to high altitude or to not adapt, which results in altitude sickness, which is what much of what I was treating in that clinic in Nepal, It's quite astounding how humans can inhabit different altitudes, and there's so many levels of adaptation too, which sort of goes back to the regulation on top of regulation of the human body's mechanism. You know, we have an adaptation that occurs over 2 days where we acclimatize to the altitude, but then over a few months, our body starts making more red blood cells to adapt to the low oxygen levels in the air. But then over generations and generations, there can be a genetic adaptation, which many people in Asia who live in the Himalayas or South America who live high in the Andes and elsewhere, they adapt too on another level to best be able to live in that harsh environment. What's interesting though is I treated a lot of people who are native to that region, who live in that town, who spent the majority of their lives at high altitude. They descend to go down to, let's say, Kathmandu, which is near sea level, and they think because they've lived there their whole life, because they're of that ethnicity, that they cannot get altitude sickness. Yet the acclimatization actually wears off in just about 2 weeks, no matter how long you've spent at high altitude. And when they return to their village, they get altitude sickness, not all the time, but sometimes. So it's interesting what people expect of their body and the adaptations that can and cannot happen. And I just want to mention one other thing. There's also another kind of adaptation I saw, for instance, when I worked in Calcutta, India. I worked in a lot of the with a lot of the population living on the street of the city and in the slums. And I think that's a different kind of adaptation that people have to live in such environments. And it's also interesting, there's so many different slums in a city like Calcutta or Mumbai or others. And some are actually beautiful, clean, neat. It looks like you're in a rural village in a placid surrounding. And others are what you'd expect of a sort of a more filthy urban slum with garbage everywhere. So there's such a variety of conditions that people live in. Not only physiologic stresses like altitude, but also sort of the social and economic, and even the climate context, because it's so warm in some of these places as well.
I want to mention two things. You mentioned India. You know, I think every Israeli that I know of who traveled Mumbai and was near the Ganges. I'm not talking about getting inside the Ganges, which is I think one of the most polluted rivers in the world, got diarrhea the second day he got there. But many Indians, just are unaffected by the dirt, which I think again a very good example of our ability to adapt, our flexibility. And the other, which I think even more surprising, is there are islands where people get their food or by diving into the sea and getting pearls, and they develop like different eye mechanism which allows them to see much clearer in the ocean. And again, it their eyes or their retina are built differently than we. So again, the level of adaptability, I think, is mind-blowing.
Absolutely. And I do think that goes back to the mechanism of the body. You know, people aren't thinking, oh, we should get better eyes to see under the water, right? It just sort of happens when you live in that area. Same thing with acclimatization. When you go to high altitude, you don't have to think about it. And the following generations aren't trying to change their genes, but it just sort of happens. And I think that's one of the beautiful and mind-boggling aspects of the human mechanism for sure.
Which leads me, I think, to another question, which is better. Let's say that I'm in Israel, in India. I'm not used to the dirt. I'm not used to the pollution, and but an in but my Indian friend is much more robust. So why do I keep investing in clean water, where if I drink unclean water, I will be more robust? So what is the threshold? The idea is that on average, I live much longer as a Western.
Well, I think it does. There are limits to adaptation. I mean, when I travel, I don't follow the advice I would give to my patients. So I eat everything, drink everything. When I went to India, and when you go to the restaurants in India, they put these metal cups on the table with water, and I did not drink them at first. And then after I was there for a few weeks, I thought to myself, oh, I'm probably used to the bacteria here now. I'll just go ahead. Started drinking, and of course, got a horrible case of diarrhea with fever and chills, which I wrote about in the feces chapter of my book, a very formative experience. But after that, I kept drinking the water and was fine. So I guess I adapted somewhat. But I think there's a limit to adaptation. There are things like typhoid and cholera and other things that I don't think you can always adapt to. It doesn't mean everyone who gets cholera gets super sick, but certainly diseases like that are more common in India than, let's say, parts of the US where the water supply is cleaner. So I do think there's limits to just the brute force method of going up against bacteria and other microorganisms.
So we are robust, but we are not that robust, which
There's
leads me to
definitely
think.
limits.
Okay. Now you mentioned, I think this is the first book, I think, that deals with feces and mucus. Mucus. I don't know how you say it in
Mucus.
English. Mucus.
Mu
Mucus.
mucus, yeah.
Mucus. So chapter 3 is feces and chapter 13 is mucus. And this is not body parts, but they used to be body parts. I don't know how to phrase it. And why feces are so important to us? And when you say feces again, because I'm an Israeli, you mean like I don't know how to say it. There is urine and shit. I'm sorry, I don't know how to say it.
That is one way to say, yeah, you could say feces, stool, you could say poop. Poop is sort of a more
Okay,
childish word,
thank
but I
you.
use it often. Yeah, these are all bodily fluids, and I wanted to include them in the book because when you learn to be a doctor, when you go to medical school, you learn a lot about every body part, which are the ones you think about, the internal organs like the brain, the heart, the liver, etc. But you also learn a ton about all the bodily fluids. And so I put some of the highlights there. But of course, there's so many others, from tears to saliva to bile to pancreatic, cerebrospinal fluid. Of course, there's so many different bodily fluids that I learned about and that I often use to diagnose disease in the emergency room. So you have to have this familiarity with these bodily fluids. And that's another thing when you pull back the curtain on sort of what it means to work in healthcare, to be a doctor or a healthcare provider. These bodily fluids, which you would normally not talk about in polite company or over dinner, become a daily part of your job and you have to get familiar with them. You see them, you smell them, you touch them with gloves on, but still. And you use them to diagnose disease. So it's sort of a, you get this familiarity with urine, mucus, and feces. Feces in particular is interesting because it's sort of the most hated, the most odious, the grossest thing that our bodies produce. Our bodies produce many gross things that people don't want to think or talk about on a daily basis. But feces is definitely the worst. And so some things I thought were super interesting about feces is that, this kind of with germ theory and everything that modern medicine learned over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, feces became the enemy, where it's full of bacteria that are going to kill us. It should be flushed away and discarded. Yet now we have this treatment called fecal microbiota transplants, where we take stool from a healthy person and they're ingested orally by people with certain kinds of colon diseases, like infections and others. And so it's almost this treatment is so fascinating because it's sort of the most iconoclastic therapy that we have in medicine. It's almost overturning everything about germ theory that we learned in the 20th century, where the odious and dangerous and disgusting becomes literally life-saving for some people. So I think that's super interesting. And I think that's part of the future of medicine, or even the past, is finding cures where you least expect them. Most of the antibiotics that we found or that we use were first discovered in a clump of dirt or in chicken shit or in other gross, seemingly totally unimportant aspects of the natural world, or the human or animal bodies. And so I think that is super interesting. So I had to write a chapter about it.
So again, in ancient Jewish scripture, one can say that according one of the punishments in hell, that they put you in a jar full of feces and they boil the jar. The idea of, again, feces is like hell. But again, what you said right now is so profound. We nowadays use some feces from a healthy man to cure, to help cure people who have a colon.
Like infections specifically. It's being experimented with other diseases too, but the main use is for colon infections.
And the idea is, I think what you just said, it's like goes against everything that we learned about germs. We learned that we need to have clean hands, and we need, you know, to get away from those parts. How so? How? What we didn't understand the concept of germs until recently? What was like the main point?
Yeah, well, I think certainly I do wonder, again, I like to think about what prehistoric peoples could have known. Did anyone in human history before the 19th century know that there were invisible microorganisms living on and in us and on top of basically everything we interact with and eat? I don't know, but perhaps. But we, you know, at least in Western medicine, we first discovered that, you know, when Van Leeuwenhoek looked in his microscope at some pond water and saw it teeming with life. And then all the way up through the 20th century, where we learned that things like cholera and typhoid and E. coli and Salmonella, Shigella, long list of bacteria, basically make a living by going from one human alimentary tract to another. And it's not nice to think about, but that basically the only way those diseases ever spread is by someone ingesting another person's stool, right? We call it the fecal oral route of disease transmission. And so, I mean, that was a huge discovery to understand how disease goes from one person to another, you know, whether it's intestinal disease or tuberculosis or malaria. Figuring out how we get those illnesses, I think, is one of the crowning achievements of humanity to date. And it was understandable that we then understood we are at war with microbes, because they are the things making us sick in many cases, and we must destroy them, and we must use antibiotics to kill them as much as possible and aggressively as possible. And now we're understanding that actually there's sort of a symbiosis there, right? We have colon bacteria that we depend on, and if they're gone, we can get very sick. And so the human mechanism actually is sort of almost a mechanism that relies on millions of other organisms living on and inside of us. And I think that that requires a bit of a change. It's not a war against microbes, but rather, I mean, sometimes you are fighting them, but sometimes you are enlisting their help. And perhaps in the future, there's some experiments where we might be able to treat bacterial infections by engineering viruses to kill them, even when they're inside of us, without hurting the host, which is the human body. So I think microbes are not always the enemy, though sometimes they are. And I think a big part of advances in medicine over the coming century will be us working together with various microbes to treat disease.
You know, I had Ravid Struzman from the Weizmann Institute on the show, and he's a world-renowned expert on microbiome. The idea is that some of those microorganisms in the stomach can help us to learn a whole new thing about the human body and about how to treat cancer, etc. Now, you know, the idea is that what we thought was not good, like feces, we nowadays said, no, it is much more complex. There is an interplay, and some of the things that we thought they are bad, in the right order, in the right magnitude, can be better. Now, there is like, the most transparent analogy is the appendix. You know, we called appendix to something that we don't need, but maybe the appendix is something that we haven't discovered yet its purpose. Okay, maybe we need, like in feces, like the microbiome, like all microbe, maybe we need to wait more, to learn more, to understand more, in order to say, this is why we need the appendix.
Yeah, I think the appendix is a great example. We all have heard that it's what we call a vestigial organ, that perhaps it's left over from some previous life form, and we don't need it anymore. I do think that that's probably wrong, and there is a purpose to the appendix, and we just haven't figured it out yet. I think just because you can cut something off the body doesn't mean it serves no purpose. You know, most people could lose their pinky toe on both feet, and the way they walk or run or jump will not change, which doesn't mean the pinky toe serves no purpose. I have heard some people theorize that the function could be related to the microbiome, like perhaps it's some sort of like training ground for the microbes. It's kind of right there, right when the small intestines goes into the large intestines, the appendix is sort of right there. So some people theorize it could be related to the microbiome. So I would say we're not sure, but I do think the body is too efficient to produce structures that serve no purpose. I think just as we talked about genetic adaptation or adaptation over generations, I think the body is so, the design is so intelligent and efficient that I don't really believe we would keep growing appendices if they did not serve any function.
Okay, now you said the design is so intelligent, and I will not go into religion, but I will go to what Alex Friedman asked you. I think the first question in your great interview was, he said, okay, how much of the human body evolved out of evolution, and how much is like the perfect fit, and how much you said, I would have engineered it differently. And you said, I think, you know, the hand, I think you started with the hand. You said it is the, you cannot make it more perfect than this. And your only counter example would be this throat, which, you know, there was two tubes, one for food and one for air. And if you make one single mistake, you can die. But then you added, maybe this is the best design based off giving the stipulation, so giving how we were conceived as a tiny tube in the womb. So if you could please elaborate on what is like the best design versus some designs that could be better.
Sure. I think the human body's design is definitely wonderful. I think the debate over was it designed by God or by millions of years of evolution is endlessly fascinating. We don't have to debate that today, though, if you want to, I'd be happy to. But I do think that almost every part of the body is sort of a, you know, when you learn about its function, you realize it's a very practical solution to a problem. So for instance, take like the liquid bile, right? Bile is a solution to a problem. Like, why do we have bile? The problem is that we're trying to digest fats using enzymes that are soluble only in water. So if they're not soluble in fat, how does that enzyme get to the lipid in our intestine and interact with it and break it down so that we can absorb it? That's a problem of the universe we live in, getting water-soluble enzymes to digest fat. So the answer, bile. Bile is sort of a soap-like molecule where half of it dissolves in fat and the other half dissolves in water. So it sort of bridges the gap and brings the enzyme close to the fat. So in that way, bile, like so many other body parts, are a really brilliant solution to a very practical, everyday problem with the human body. So it's brilliant. And I think, like I said, the human hand as well. I don't want to be so prideful to suggest I can improve on the design that was happened over millions of years of evolution or by a creator. But, you know, certain things make you question a bit. For instance, the throat, like you mentioned, right? So we do have these two tubes. And every time we swallow, right, we swallow throughout the day when we're eating, when we're not eating, we swallow unconsciously throughout the day. Even at night when we're sleeping, we're constantly swallowing. Swallowing itself means food and drink go very close to the air tube, right? And as you said, if you make one small mistake, you could die or get very sick. You know, in the book, I talk about how treating a lot of old and debilitated patients who with mental and physical decline sort of showed me a different aspect of the throat. So people with a lot of neurodegenerative diseases, multiple strokes or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementia, their body, specifically the brain, but other parts of the body too, stop working correctly. And often these people, in some studies, a majority of people with these neurodegenerative diseases die from food and drink or saliva going down the wrong tube, going into the windpipe and into the lungs, causing a pneumonia. So I wonder in the throat chapter, I wonder if perhaps, you know, that is another, perhaps not as unintelligent as I thought, aspect of the human body's design.
As a self-destruction mechanism. A very right, efficient self-destruction mechanism.
Exactly. It's a cyanide pill in your necklace where if you get into serious trouble, it's sort of like a way out. So when people's lives become difficult and painful and they can't, you know, the mental function is gone or nearly gone, it's sort of this, they end up aspirating, as we call it, and getting aspiration pneumonia. And that's a very common way that people die. It even used to be called old man's friend because the pneumonia was seen as sort of bringing an end, a dignified end to prolonged suffering. Obviously, not everybody with these diseases should die. Obviously, I'm not saying that. But as anyone who's had a relative who declined and you know, went through the difficulties of declining mind and declining body, they know that these are very difficult and life can become very painful. And so some reprieve is welcome sometimes.
Yo, this is great. I think there is a question and there is a very famous joke about it. Why to put the genitalia and I mean the sex organs along with the urine organ? So it's like the fun part with the not fun part. And the idea is...
That's just your idea of fun.
in Hebrew, I can convey the message much, much better, okay? But the idea is that you need your sex organs for like from, I don't know, to reproduce from 20 to 40, but you need to urinate, I think, your entire life. So you need a process, you need an organ that will be active in that time when you need it, but it must be active. So maybe the idea to combine the genitals with the urine part is not a bad idea after all. Maybe it's a very intelligent idea, very efficient idea. Would you agree?
I do think it is an efficient idea. It's worth pointing out, though, that so in men, we have on that part of our body, we have only two holes, right? One for urine and sperm and the other for feces. But women have three holes. So the separate hole, vagina, urethra for urine and feces. But I think it all sort of comes from the same thing as the throat and esophagus, right? Because we begin as a very tiny microscopic tube. The human body starts as a tube, basically, with an opening on one end and an exit on the other end. And as we grow in the womb, the entrance and the exit get more and more complicated. And the entrance ends up becoming everything sort of in our face, our nose, our mouth, our ears, our throat. Everything stems from one entrance, which is part of the reason that the air tube and the food tube sort of are so close together, because they started as one tube in the womb. And then the exit of that single tube becomes sort of all the other, you know, on the other end of the body, where everything comes out, from feces to urine to babies to sperm. And so it's sort of efficient. And we are basically just very complicated tubes. Cute. With the entrance up here. And we like to interact with other tube entrances and then all the exits on the other side, which we also sometimes interact with.
So again, let's say that it's given that you start as a tube and then you can, you know, and make it more complex. The anatomy of the human body, I think, is optimal, even for the throat. This, I think, your case. So given that we must start with this, and we must start with this in order, you know, for the human womb to carry everything, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, you know, many people say that the time of pregnancy for human beings is 1 month, but it is 1 year, but the last 3 months are performed outside the womb. So otherwise the head will be too big to get out. So again, given the restrictions, what we have is an optimal design. And again, one can say it's an evolutionary design, and one can say it's an evolutionary design guided from the future, or God. Now, there is a great book, a great Hebrew book called White God, White Doctor Black God, and it tells the story of Uri Schwarzman, who is a psychiatrist in Papua New Guinea. And the idea that I think his basic theory is what people in the West consider mental cases, people in Papua New Guinea or in other societies will consider, you know, to be the chief, or to treat very differently. And my question is, where did you see it throughout your voyages around the world, that what can be considered very bad or again mental case in one society could be treated very differently in another society?
It's a very interesting question. I do think about this a lot, though. I don't know the answer for sure, but I do think that, I've heard, for instance, in certain societies, perhaps the schizophrenic person would become the shaman or the healer or the visionary. And I think there's something very attractive to that. I guess my perspective on psychiatric disease is very shaped by my daily job, which is in an emergency room. And so most people who I see with psychiatric disease are people where it's so severe that they cannot operate in their daily life, or they're a danger to themselves, or they're a danger to other people, or they are thinking about hurting themselves, or already tried to hurt themselves and we save them. I guess from that standpoint, it makes me wonder, like I doubt a chief or a shaman would be suicidal, or would be so disorganized and divorced from reality that they cannot carry out their daily functions, or don't sleep, or don't eat. But so I do think, mental disease is a spectrum. There's more mild aspects too. And I think there certainly seems to be some connection, let's say, with creativity and artistic ability. Specifically, some studies I've seen more with like bipolar disease than schizophrenia, where the mania sort of activates people in various ways and activates their creativity. Perhaps, I on my daily in my daily job, I don't see those mild cases because those people can function in daily life. So I'm seeing the completely non-functional people with psychiatric disease. And I don't believe that severity would be useful in any society, prehistoric or modern. But I certainly think that perhaps more mild cases could have certainly have served societies in various parts of the world.
But maybe, like I think Louis C.K. says, or Dave Chappelle, maybe lactose intolerant is non-existent in Africa, just in the US. Maybe people with such a, maybe we afford ourselves to become, such very heavy, serious mental cases, because we know somehow that there will be someone who will take care. And if we knew that there is no thing like, national health treatment or national healthcare, things will be turned out differently. And I do think that lactose intolerant is a great example. How come we have so many lactose intolerant in the West that if they eat like a peanut butter, they will die? How come we don't?
You're referring to allergies also?
Yes,
like
yes.
Peanut allergies.
Yes. Or lactose intolerant in general and peanut allergy. In Israel, we have like the national snake, which is Bamba. And I don't know if you're familiar. And
yes.
My friend just moved to London and they said, we are not allowed Bamba in the house because many people here are peanut intolerant. So,
right.
It's like the national anthem of Israel, Bamba. And there in London, we have so many peanut intolerant. How
it's
come?
A great question. I don't know that we even know the answer to that, but that's certainly certainly a very bewildering aspect of modern life and modern society. It surely seems to be some aspect of modern life that is causing the immune system to go haywire in this way, right? And allergies are kind of a overreaction of the immune system to things that are not dangerous, right? The mechanisms of the immune system are there to fight things that are actually dangerous, but obviously peanut butter is not dangerous. But the immune system has sort of different branches, almost like a military, army, navy, air force. There's one branch of the immune system that is designed to fight parasites. And that's the same branch that goes haywire in allergies. So some people think perhaps it's the lack of parasites in modern life with our clean water supply and food supply that leads to that branch of the immune system going haywire. I don't know that that's proven, but in America, intestinal parasites and other parasites are pretty rare, hookworm and tapeworm and such. And so there's a theory that that could be related as well. And, pediatricians in the U.S. for a long time told parents not to give their children peanut butter until they were 1 year old. And lo and behold, when we finally studied it, we found that was actually perhaps leading to more peanut allergies. And so now they say, oh, give your child peanut butter or some peanut containing food, when you start solid foods from 4 to 6 months old. So perhaps doctors were contributing to that to some extent. And lactose intolerance is a little bit different just because it's not an allergy, but it's actually like, you know, the human body's designed to drink milk for the first part of life. And then historically, we don't drink much milk after that. And so the enzyme in our intestines just sort of goes away because it's not needed anymore. Like the appendix would if it was truly not needed anymore. It should just sort of disappear. The body should stop manufacturing it because it's a waste of time and energy and raw material. So, but these are some very interesting aspects of modern life that we have not figured out yet.
I think, you know, one of the, and I had David Bass on the show and about evolutionary psychology, and I had many scholars on evolutionary biology. And I think one of the profound questions regarding evolutionary biology is, okay, we were created in the, or we were adapted, or our brain and body were adapted in the savannas of Africa, but nowadays we are living in New York. So, how it's like oh, the same old excuse again, the savannah of Africa. But I don't live in the savannah of Africa, you know, for the last 20,000 years. So what's going on? How come? How come you said that we can adapt to height in 2 weeks, and we can adapt and produce more blood cells, you know, in 2 months, but we didn't bridge the gap of 2,000 years? How come? How come our body didn't understand that nowadays we live in New York and not in Africa?
Well, I do think that the way we live in modern life does show how adaptable the human body is for sure. You know, I think it takes many generations, hundreds perhaps, to really evolve. I do wonder if you live in a city for generations, what the adaptations would be there. Perhaps worse hearing or something like that to protect you from the noise of the city. But you know, I think so. I've worked and traveled in the Arctic as well, and I think that gives you the best example of how adaptable the human body is. Because you know, the ancestors of the Inuit or the Inupiat Eskimo in northern Alaska, where I worked, they are from their ancestors, if you believe in evolution, are from the savannas of Africa, or if you believe in that historical story, as I do. You know, so their bodies were also adapted and evolved on in a very warm climate, you know, with dry seasons and wet seasons. And now they live in a area in a part of the world where there's, you know, a very long winter, a very short summer, months of all light, months of no light. Not to mention the diet. You know, in the very far Arctic, traditionally the diet has zero plant matter, and it's pure meat and fat of animals. Sometimes they would traditionally eat actually some of the partially digested lichen from the stomach of the caribou, and that was the only plant matter available, a kind of salad, if you will. But I think the human body is so adaptable that we can live in the Arctic and we can live in cities. And I think that, you know, I've lived in cities before. I went to college in New York, and my savanna adaptation seemed perfectly fine. I loved my time there. So I like to think about when we talk about adaptability, you know, there's so much debate these days about what we should be eating or what's natural for us to be eating. And, you know, if you're on one side of the political spectrum, you think we should be vegan. And if you're on the other side, you think we should be pure carnivore, which I find very
Paleo,
fascinating.
paleo.
But I think the answer is that it depends. It's an individual decision. There's a differences in individual physiology. And the amazing thing is that humans actually can live as vegan or can live as pure carnivore because our alimentary canals are so adaptable and our bodies are so, the mechanisms are so brilliant that we can really eat almost anything. You know, you might live a longer or have less certain kinds of disease, but clearly people are living to adulthood and beyond on those two very different diets.
Oh, thank you. This is great. Now, okay, we don't have much time left, so with your permission, let's move on to the harder questions. Okay, so we're just messing around with fun questions, and let's move on. You are also a student of the history of medicine, and you went over many literature of medicine, including from Russia, etc. First, it seemed that medicine started in the 20th century. So we know that we had, you know, Hippocrates' oath and many other, but all the good practices and the profound understanding, it seems that started only in the last 100 years. Would you share this observation or feeling, or say, no, we knew a lot, like th in 300 years ago.
I think most of what I do, most of the medicines I give, most of the understandings that I think about when I'm, let's say, evaluating a patient and wondering what might be causing their symptoms, I think do come from the from let's say most of the 20th century. I think a lot of that started in the late 19th century with discovering microorganisms and understanding germ theory. I believe that was just before the turn of the century. And I think actually a lot of the technology, like plastics and different kinds of metals, and a lot of the like very m basic material culture, the material advances that we've had over the 20th century also made it possible to do a lot of these medical experiments and treatments. You know, plastic is so, we use so much plastic in medicine, from the IV bags to the catheters to the you know, containers for things. It's amazing what, just to think about what plastic, for instance, has done for modern medicine. Not to mention all the technical abilities that we have, you know, with catheters and things like that. I do think a lot of what we did in the past was probably harmful, or at least not helpful. But even I was looking the other day at how at Massachusetts General Hospital, where I did residency, their protocol for treating heart attacks in the 1960s is absurd. It makes no sense. If you look at it from today's perspective, it's almost like
Again,
you shake
in
your
the
head.
1960s, it's like
1960.
50 years ago. Again, no, it's not close. Yes, 40, 60, 60 years
Maybe
ago.
60.
But again, it is not like 300 years ago when Descartes used to say it about the pineal cord, etc., about the pineal gland. It's in the 1960s in Massachusetts, the procedure for how to deal with heart attack is absurd in modern day terms. This is basically what you're saying.
Correct. It's absurd, and it was probably more harmful than helpful. For instance, they people would be hospitalized for weeks sometimes, you know, probably unnecessarily. And there's a lot of complications to laying in bed and staying in the hospital that long. So now we try to get people up and moving as quick as possible, no matter what disease they have. Even people on ventilators in ICU sometimes are actually woken up and walked around with their ventilator still in, because laying in a hospital bed we know is so dangerous.
Now,
And I, but yeah,
before
but I'm sorry, go ahead, Ron.
the idea is, again, medicine had a tremendous progress. You know, when my first boy, when my first child was born, before the breed is like in, he had, I don't know, I said diabetes, I think, diabetes, and they put him under ultraviolet light.
He had
That's
jaundice.
it. Yes, and this is great. Ultraviolet light. Like in fried chips, okay? And that's all. This is a very simple procedure that 100 years ago and even 50 years ago, newborns could die from this very, very simple non-invasive procedure, which is great. Medicine had done a great progress. But my question is, since and your book is divided into throat, hand, etc. In Harrison internal medicine, we are focused, we have a unique expert for each subdomain. And maybe this is what holds Western medicine from getting to the new revelation. This is why we can treat broken arm very efficiently, but we basically don't really know how to cure cancer or how to deal with pain. And maybe other holistic approaches, like this Chinese approach, which is profoundly different than the Western approach, should be taken into consideration for the next 100 years of Western medicine.
I certainly think that's true. One thing I just want to point out is the light that your kid was under wasn't ultraviolet light, but just a kind of blue light. And it's a specific wavelength of blue light. And what's interesting is that that wavelength is in sunlight, right? Sunlight has every wavelength of the visible spectrum. So if you take a child who's jaundiced and put them in the sun, I mean, you don't want to do that because you don't want to get them to get sunburned. But if they're near a window, not in direct sun, that actually does some of that effect as well. So perhaps in the past, when people were living outdoors more, you know, all their babies got that blue light from the sun. But I think it's important to realize that, yes, a lot of the advances have come in the last few decades. It's important to remember that, for instance, the first vaccine known to Western medicine was in the 1700s, the smallpox vaccine using cowpox. So we're building on traditions that are older than the last century for sure. But I think you're right that a holistic approach is essential. You know, we know so much about each body part and each bodily fluid that we do need subspecialists, right? I know a little bit about every body part, but when it's a complicated case of heart failure or a heart attack, I need a cardiologist to help me. I'm not trained and don't have the knowledge to do what needs to be done. But the importance of a holistic approach, actually, this came up yesterday when I was working. So one of the big advances in newborn baby care is to treat when the mother has colonization with something called Group B strep, a kind of bacteria that, you know, sometimes grows in the vagina of pregnant women and can severely affect the newborn, causing severe infection. So to treat that, they now give antibiotics to the mother before birth, and that protects the baby. And just getting that to be a recommended, like an accepted policy, meant that obstetrics and pediatrics had to work together. And that took a lot of overcoming barriers and overcoming separate silos and a lot of holistic interaction between the two specialties to coordinate that. And now it's become standard practice, and the rates of Group B strep infection in newborns is much lower than it used to be. So I do think there are other simple cures, you know, something as simple as blue light, let's say, that we could use. And I do think that doctors have to think out of the box to discover some of those new things. So maybe that's good for generalists like me, you know, who are not just focused on one organ, but the whole body.
Wow, this is great. And I think, you know what? In your opinion, given, you know, the advances in artificial intelligence and genomics and bioinformatics, where the next breakthrough in medicine will come from? In what domain, in what discipline? Will it be cancer? Because again, from what the idea of chemotherapy means basically, from my understanding, is we don't know how to deal with it, so we will kill everything. Hopefully, the cancer will be dead also. And I think, you know, maybe I read Bernie Siegel book about, you know, some patients are exceptionals. Some patients can find the faith within them or the willpower to overcome cancer or to overcome many diseases that others just cannot. And maybe, just maybe, we can, you know, get the essence of those extraordinary patients that can heal themselves. There is a great quote by Voltaire, I think, that the doctor or the medical doctor job is to entertain the patient while nature heals him. And I think that we are not focused enough in the idea of faith, not religious faith, in the importance of faith in the healing process. And I think what Bernie Siegel said, I had cases, and he's not a lunatic, he was a cancer surgeon. I've recorded many cases of people who just using faith and their willpower were able to manage things that, according to literature, we know that no one can manage. So what's your take on that?
It's a good question. You know, the role of patient psychology certainly is important. you know, I guess I don't have a lot of experience that with that myself. I do diagnose a lot of cancer in the ER, actually, but then I do not follow patients beyond that to sort of know how they do. I certainly think psychology plays a role, and I think these cases, these exceptional cases, are important to study to understand what's going on, and perhaps it can be applied to other areas or perhaps turned into treatments. For instance, there's a certain kind of genetic mutation some people have where they cannot be infected with HIV. And that was the Chinese scientist who got in trouble. He had genetically engineered a few babies to have that genetic mutation to not get HIV. And there's a lot of controversy around this new technology for sure. But I do think such, you know, getting the exceptional cases and studying them can lead to many treatments, such as in that case. And I do think gene therapy is going to be big, and there's a lot of trials already going on. You know, we might be able to cure sickle cell disease, for instance, with CRISPR, which has already been done and perhaps will become more common. So I think genetic manipulation will be a huge thing. And as you mentioned, I think more targeted therapies will be the future. So just as you said, chemotherapy is basically poisoning people. You just poison the cancer cells faster than the healthy cells. And I think we will have more targeted treatments in the future, especially by analyzing the genes of the cancer cells, which is already sort of a reality in some kinds of cancer. And the same thing goes for antibiotics, right? When we treat a pneumonia, those antibiotics, it's sort of like a bazooka used to kill a fly. It's sort of overkill because you kill the bacteria causing the pneumonia, but you're also killing a lot of the normal healthy microorganisms, let's say, in that patient's colon. And that leads to some of those colon diseases that then need a fecal transplant to cure. But so I think antibiotics also one day perhaps will be more targeted as well, perhaps by harnessing viruses that'll specifically kill only the pathogenic bacteria, not the good ones. So I do think, I also think another thing though that's very important to realize is just as we talked about, the way doctors do things, when you look at it 60 years later, often looks ridiculous and absurd and dangerous and harmful for the patient. And there's no doubt in my mind that that is true for some proportion of what I do every day for my patients. And I long for the day when there's evidence to show me what I'm doing that is helping and what I'm doing that's either doing nothing or hurting the patient. So in a way, I often say the future of medicine in some ways is doing less. Because a lot of what we do, I think, is not helpful. It makes sense in our minds that, oh, this is how the disease happens, and therefore this is the cure. A lot of things make sense in our minds, but then when you study them, they actually don't improve the patient outcome. So I think more targeting, which also means sometimes doing less, and like you said, letting the body heal itself without giving some unnecessary medicine that then gets all the credit for the cure.
And again, in the big Israel strike in all hospitals in Israel a few years ago, we had recorded much less people who died because
Oh boy.
just let nature do its thing. Jonathan Reisman, thank you so much for coming. It was again, I have no other word than mind-blowing conversation regarding the human body, the unseen body, and the cover of your book is wonderful again. If
Thank you.
you could suggest another book for understanding the beauty of the human body, what will be another book besides your book, of course?
Of course. Well, thank you very much for those words, Roy. I think, well, there's a book called The Body Book by Bill Bryson that is also has a lot of eye-opening and very interesting and entertaining stories about how the body works. That I highly recommend.
Okay, the body book guide for occupants. Oh,
Occupants, yes, like people
occupants, yes.
occupying those bodies, which is us, of course.
this is great. Okay, Jonathan Reisman, thank you so much again.
Thank you for having me.